real is a value. Like, I think certain activities seem to be a value. Good meal seems to be a value.
Food, I'll go with that.
That thing's a value, turn around and bite your ass. I have too much food. Definitely not good. Job seems to be a value, but that's not so bad. Even this. If there didn't seem to be some judgment that this was a value, I wouldn't be here. I'd be fishing around doing something else.
That's what you think.
Then there's free will. The concept of free will. Huge value. More than getting a car, going wrong. Think what you want and say what you want, even if you're being recorded. That really is a value. It doesn't mean anything. I think at the root, that's why we come around. We're looking for something that gives us more value than what we seem to be living in. But come on, let's find something that truly has value. It doesn't just go away. It seems to be more succulent than your average humdrum existence.
Could be that. Or not. Well, the reflex of assessing or measuring your life according to value, certainly a value that you choose, is dreamt.
It makes me insane, actually. Like that optimization, that trying to get new value, and try to use it and all that.
That's right.
It isn't freedom. It's not helpful.
That's right.
And yet I seem to try to use that as a way to navigate.
Well, it's common for any of us as a compensatory mechanism to relate to living through the filter of greed.
Yeah.
Because valuing things and making sure that they're optimal at a minimum or perhaps maximal, which is preferred, is greed. Yeah. It's the presumption that your experience had better be above average.
And if certain people fail to deliver that,
sure, cut them out of the will, yeah. Right. Yeah, so that's it's a reflex of preference, presumption, entitlement, and ultimately greed. Greed that the quality of being suit one's expectations.
It is greed that brings me here.
Okay. Could be.
Some greed, some other sort of.
Who knows? It could be a subtle magnetism for the cessation of greed. Even the fabric of one's consciousness, psychiatric profile, conditioning, is as real as you want it to be, as much of a myth as you are able to see through it, without having to modify it at all. The moment you self-assess or evaluate, then, you're a person in time. And suffering from the assertion of preference and a constant scorecard terms of how one self-measures one's experience. Are you stacking up to satisfy yourself even? Is life stacking up? Is everything going your way? And if it's somehow shy of going your way, then watch out.
It never for very long goes your way. That's the nature of it.
Well, even your way is in constant and impersonal flux.
Yeah.
So you've got two moving trains. One is what you think is the durable nature of your desire, preference, and entitlement. And the other is the myth of whether things are satisfying that always moving target. Yeah. In that way, it's a chaos field. Well, that doesn't make it bad, right? It's just a chaos field. And you attempt to assume or assert meaning on a chaos field from the point of view of, first of all, my durable desires, and second of all, how well they're being fulfilled by circumstances and events. Good luck.
To keep track of things, like time just quickly erases things so quickly. Like, I used to think I was well organized. It's not the case. Everything, it's sort of like as soon as you move off something, it's like something gets mixed up and you shuffle around and the shells get moved. You can't pin it down anymore. It seems like I used to be able to.
You could say that one of the impulses for our control dramas is the instinct that this is a chaos field. And we're compensating for that insight. But that insight is not the conscious insight. What is conscious is our assertions and control impulses. That's what's going on, that's conscious. And the failure that life is satisfying our needs and expectations. You could say that's conscious, right? That element of samsara is conscious. I want, I didn't get. I want, I got. But underneath that is, you could say, an instinct that this is actually chaos, and you don't like it.
Doesn't feel safe.
As you explore it, all kinds of interesting revelations can appear. As you really explore the root of your already present intuition and instinct that this is chaos and that you don't like it, all kinds of interesting discoveries can be made. But we rarely do that. For instance, let's say with, you know, professional clients, I would imagine very few actually look at the root of the intuition of chaos itself. Instead, we're all dwelling in the symptom of all the dissatisfiers. Because the compensatory mechanisms to organize chaos according to my safety needs fail all the time. Nonstop failure. Your whole egoic life is nonstop failure. And yet we cling to it.
Do you think we're noticing it more now? Like, it never seemed to be like this, like quite so out of control. I think maybe I just notice it more. Perhaps. You always thought things were gone.
Well, if your lid's on tight.
It seems to be so out of control.
If your lid is on tight.
It used to be on a light.
You fool yourself. Right? You fool yourself into thinking that you're not out of control. You're organized.
Yeah.
Right? You're moral. You handle financial affairs.
Yes.
And the laundry.
Yeah.
And the food.
The weeds.
In a certain way. And so you're okay. You're safe.
Yeah.
Because the unconscious impulse to make safe out of chaos is running the show. So you appear to yourself as in control. when to anyone that knows you is like, she's out of fucking control, that girl. But you don't notice it. Because the compensatory mechanisms have, for a time being, won. Now, as they start to relax, you can see how remarkably and lusciously out of control you are. How lusciously out of control this is. But that same reflex that may have gotten strong at, you know, through childhood, now in adulthood doesn't react the same way to the instinct and intuition of chaos. It might actually respond with greater relaxation, greater joy, different quality of homecoming, a more mature acceptance. So the process of unwinding or becoming unfettered from control dramas, control mechanisms, compensatory mechanisms of control can be very unsettling. And as we feel more confident with the presence of chaos as non-harming, but the presence of chaos as a road to bliss, then we'll back off those compensatory mechanisms, and we might see how out of control this is or I am now that I've released myself from, right, this uber and unconscious commitment to making sure everything is under my control or under control. Look at how we use the artifacts of our life to assert and insist upon control. And it's not satisfying. Even if it is going my way, we don't get the pleasure we thought we should get from things going my way.
What happens when it doesn't go your way? You start worried about that.
It's good. Yeah, it's unending. The conviction of an individuated self as a disparate creature is insane. So no attempt at control or extroversion is going to work or actually bring you anywhere, like peace or freedom or security or God knows what. It all fails. I mean, completely fails. It's remarkably forgiving in some respects because it's an unencumbered miracle of being. But it's very unforgiving when it comes to any of us thinking we can retain some modicum of control.
If you're insisting that it be a certain way, you're going to lose
it. That's it. You're going to lose every time.
Well, it's going to hurt.
Yes, and it will hurt. Yeah. What is it like to back off from thought as the principal authority for your present experience? She's enjoying her dinner, she said. You see, all the neurosis is simply because we, this, identifies with thought as the principal authority on reality. And it's not. It's that simple.
It could jump up and be like right there, right next to you. Giving you the business, telling you how it is, telling you what you should do. No, really, quit now. And it's like, can you just say thanks? And
yeah.
You're still just here.
It's always the case. It's always the case that you, if there is such a thing, or just here, if there were such a place. And thought means nothing. Even the miracle of, you know, medicine or engineering or research or things that you could say rely on thought to have gotten so far, right, is not true. Because the miracle of all that revelation, including the science and the medicine and the technology and the telescoping and the microscoping and the particle acceleration, is not the result of thought. It's a consequence of radiance. Thought comes along for the ride. Our capacity for using, right, the neocortex to imagine profound pattern and then the opposable thumb to machine it has nothing to do with thought.
Think it does.
See? You think it does. Yeah. Yeah. The miracle of all primate progress, whether in the arts or the sciences or anywhere in between, is not the consequence of thought. Thought is an artifact. Thought just comes along for the ride. Which would suggest that you can retreat entirely from thought and not be at risk.
And not be like, I feel like I have moments of that.
It's,
you
nice.
Know when you're like driving the car and going to the other one? Just so to see. You end up at one bay, not quite sure how you got there, and you haven't drank, or maybe that's not the best example.
Well, it's enough to say you have moments of it. Of course you do. That same intuition that knows that this is an unmanageable chaos also knows that this is not the consequence, nor are you the consequence, nor is your security or sustenance the consequence or dependent upon thought. You already know this. Thought doesn't light up unless you attend to it.
It seems to get louder when you don't attend to it.
Shh, take the energy of awareness and bring it elsewhere. Well, let's say occupy the entire auric field, right, of your bioluminescent expression. Bring your awareness there. You can. Your awareness is steerable.
Like bring it out here somewhere?
Great. Start there. Anywhere. Yeah.
Or field? Or,
sure. But anywhere.
The tree?
Great. Sure. You'll notice how quickly thought starves. If your attention goes elsewhere. You see, thoughts does not operate independently. It has no genuine authority or reality. Attention animates thought. And you, as a yogi, can practice and play with tuning or attenuating attention elsewhere. You're doing it all the time anyway. You just don't notice that you have that magical power.
Well, sometimes those times when driving and not paying attention is all going in thought to me. You know, that dissociative thinking.
Yes. Yeah.
So I don't...
Yeah, thought can be dissociative and not even remembered.
Yeah.
Or some thought can appear to be very willful and deliberate and recalled with some weird degree of accuracy. I mean, how much do you... Here you are. This is your life right now. This is the dwelling place of the divine. How much do you remember? Not a thing.
Yeah, what I do remember is that I remember when I'm driving around, I'm playing conversations. Sometimes it's very entertaining.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
But I don't know if that is less preferable than staring at the sky.
Yeah. Well, you can't. You can't really measure any particular state against another state, since states don't matter anyway. I mean, there's really no point in comparing one state to another.
There's no point when it happens.
Well, sure, it's, you know, just a natural consequence of rumination, of association. Yeah. When we become enrolled in thought through measure, through comparison, through preference, through storytelling, to entertain, to justify, it's unreal.
And it takes us away from what is real. That's the shame of it. It really does. You can just, like you were saying, you're stuck in your head, running stuff. And you miss what's right in front of you. It seems to me that.
It's funny, when I had surgery and I kind of just really liked to see what they say, it would be like every time I took it, then I would sort of also remember the previous time I took the opiate, and it was, I don't know if it just anchored that memory in place, but it was kind of like sometimes a daydream.
How about this present moment? How good are you at grasping this?
Roger.
I don't know.
Is this the moment?
Can you grasp this? It's impossible to grasp. That's why it's kind of a foolish advice, whether Buddhist or otherwise, to suggest stop grasping. Why stop something you could never do in the first place? Your present experience is impossible to grasp. Just as much so, and maybe amplified, of course, under the influence of something that gives you a little more rubber room. Right? You can see it more clearly. If you're under the influence of something that opens the aperture, how impossible it is to grasp. It's impossible to grasp this. but you could say the association with thought gives us a false sense of confidence that we are meaningfully and soberly grasping this.
Well, there is this.
Or not.
That there's like a pleasurable sort of thought process to anchor back, you know, say, physiologically, that is, you know, this push pull with that. That feels interesting. You feel like death, I guess. That's the thing of it. So, like, it's calling me now. Come back here. I mean, even like, because the work I do is so much about, it's like a practice, because so much, you know, if I'm hungry, it's like, how can I eat? Like, I have to constantly sort of like, okay, listen, don't think about food. This is my last patient on a Friday, and I really want to get the heck out of here, you know.
It's good training. Yeah. It's good training.
I break it. I'm gonna like break out of sweat. I'm gonna like get out of like anxiety. Like, if there's like a whole family there, like, might as well be in a sweat lodge. Like,
I think I'd like to see myself professionally. Let's say you want an ideal position for what you call present awareness. Right? You want your present awareness to be in the best spot, the most lucid. Otherwise, anchoring wouldn't even make any sense. Anchoring suggests you want your awareness, your experience, to be seated somewhere, to be of a certain quality. Maybe because Ram Dass said, be here now, so he didn't know what he was talking about.
Why am I doing it?
Ah, that's a good question. That's a very good question. Because you see how subtle it is that to micromanage your consciousness.
So are you saying it's not happening, or the micromanagement is happening, or it's just like that's misguided?
The incentive to micromanage your present experience is a dream.
Let's try to get a sense of control.
But it seems to have a result.
Does it? How you doing?
Well, it seems
this present moment is the result of everything that you've pulled off. How's it going? You're no better or worse for anything that's happened prior to this moment.
Is it not the
because again, you're thinking of mind or consciousness as as a source, certain. You're not actually occupying this moment, nor is your consciousness actually occupying this moment. Check it out. Test it.
Well, the moment's being occupied.
Maybe. Who knows?
If you want to call it a moment is a word that I don't know.
Me neither. Yeah, I don't know either. See, anytime we assign a condition, whether by recalling the past or evaluating the present, or hoping to improve in the future. It's an impulse of micromanaging the bizarre nature of what we call consciousness.
But if it's doing itself, then it's not micromanaging.
Yes. Right. Yes. Well, it's kind of like, how is it appearing in your experience? Right?
Oh, I see. If it's appearing as micromanaging.
Yeah. You can appreciate the geometry that if I'm assessing the quality of my consciousness or the quality of my experience, whether it's dissociative, whether it's associative, whether it's present, whether it's absent, whether it's entertaining itself, whether it's torturing itself. Right? It's like, is there an uber you that can meaningfully address, evaluate your present experience that then wants to exercise a steering capacity to improve the present experience?
But there's still some sense of, like, it's all doing itself, but then we're also using words to say, don't micromanage, or are we not? Or is it just
yes, it's, yes. You can say it's all doing itself.
Yeah.
And, you know, a whole bunch of people would say, yeah, she's got that right.
Everything else is wrong.
But it's only even having confidence in, you know, some suggestion that this is doing itself doesn't have any value.
It doesn't have any value.
No.
But nothing does.
That's right.
Yeah.
In that case, yeah, nothing has any value. Right. So you can use any one of these metaphors as a paint stripper. Strip the paint off your soul. Strip all the paint off so that one's confidence in being disparate, separate, willful, consequential, right? Just evaporates. So that's all we're doing, using words, metaphors, and funny little tidbits here and there as, you know, to strip the paint off. It's not like anything is true.
It seems helpful, though, to stay in this conversation because we kind of get whirled back into the thought land of your own crappity crap. But it's easy to see other people's crappity crap, at least for me, and it's very interesting. You know what I mean? Getting whirled into their own whirlwind, into their own self-destructive thought patterns. Of course, I can't see my own, but I can see theirs.
It's a good start. Having clear seeing, even into others, could be a bridge for clearer seeing into your own experience.
Shadow.
That's present too. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Anchoring there is going to get you closer to the source than the cortical. But I know it's all the same shit.
Yeah, well, you're already too late.
Yeah.
Because you have to. Well, let's use the word "do it now." And doing it now, or appreciating it now, is right, very different than a hopeful strategy that I may deploy in my future. Because doing it now is the flatlining of, right, all concept, of all tautology.
You mean like independent of those strategies that I was referring to in the past, and doing it now in terms of...
Well, this is awake right now. It's not encumbered. It's not the consequence of anything. Right? So the moment I impose, in a good way, in an ideal way, in a committed and sincere way, a certain kind of strategy, then I'm delusional again. Yeah. Yeah. This is very, very, very good at offering you a watch. Delusion on tap.
The mental keeps mirroring back some sense of, okay.
It does.
And we all play along.
It appears so.
Or it plays along.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, the idea that something's being helped or not helped, then the myths will play along and they do that.
Yeah? Myth and delusion are self-fulfilling. They're happy to be on your team. They love you. Myth and delusion are crazy about you. As far as they're concerned, you are the shit. And they're not going anywhere.
So every time there appears to be change, there's a myth that fills in the blank. I don't know.
Yeah. 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 Yes. Myth and delusion are spontaneously appearing through the subtlety of identification and association, of strategy, of being of the nature of an individuated consciousness.
Like if you climb the mountain and you see the guru, and he says, and you say, how am I doing? And he says, you're perfect, you're good to go.
Great. Yeah.
And yeah. Just reflects back.
Did you bring any whitefish? Did you bring whitefish and bagels, or you just came up here for some fucking advice?
That's, no, that's a New Yorker cartoon.
Yeah, that's
it. That.
Yeah, yeah. That is definitely a New Yorker cartoon. Master, I've come all this way. Did you bring whitefish?
Quit your day job.
Yeah. Definitely quit your day job. Or don't, as they often say.
I'll be your Jewish mother.
Fantastic. This is wholly unreal. And yet presents with, right, profound corporeal confidence. Amazing.
Yeah, it just goes along with the rock.
Yeah.
So how come we have to talk so much? Yeah, what are we doing here?
It doesn't
does
mind.
Does it appear to be fruitful or not?
What do you do on Friday night?
Oh, we talk in circles.
Before you take yourself as a body or a mind, you have the intelligence and the capacity to see what it is that's occupying the idea of body and mind. Rather than presuming that you are a done deal as body, a done deal as mind, see what it is that is animating the imagination, the idea that you are body and mind. And you have the intelligence and the creativity to do this. Because body and mind are artifacts, they're after the fact.
get up and
live. So if we occupy the miracle of living through the filter of body and mind, then we're only living in the artifact. And therefore irritable and loaded with control dramas. But this can also see itself, occupy itself, anchor itself, fine, right? As, oh my goodness. You mean I'm the radiance that pretends to be body and mind? You're like, yeah. Yeah, that's what I've been kind of hinting at. Just hinting. You are the radiance that pretends to occupy itself as body-mind. You are not the body, not the mind. And this is all, you know, this is straight, you know, Vedanta. So, awareness, free to come and go, just this, simply becomes admiring of itself as a consequence, body-mind. So it conducts its affairs, financial and otherwise, through the filter of, oh, I'm body-mind, so I do this shit. To improve body, improve mind. To indulge here, not indulge there, go to a 12-step meeting, not go to one, maybe get enlightened. You know, I want it all. I want to go on the vegan cruise and to the Brazilian steakhouse and get enlightened.
That sounds sexy.
I'm down with that.
Anyway. This guy in my acupuncture class said something one time. It just like struck me like a ton of bricks. It's like every 100 years, like the face of the earth changes. Like there's no, like the people, like all of us will be gone. There'll be like a new set of people.
Sure. Yes.
And like, you know, so like George Washington and his troops like marched to this area and there were people, and you know, this was a couple, a few hundred years ago, whatever, there was like people, and they were doing things where, like, you're riding in a train and you go past like houses and you wonder kind of like, there's those people, they're kind of like doing things in their houses, you know, like, they're doing things, they've got lives, and like, they're doing things, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Or like, it all seems a little surreal sometimes, like.
Good.
Do you know what I mean?
That's a 3-point shot right there. So swoosh.
And I'm wondering
totally
if, that
surreal.
Maybe, if that was, if what I'm describing is maybe. The objective opinion of my non-mind.
Fair enough.
Just seeing like, oh, there's, you know, me doing, people doing, oh, my neighbor, okay, she died. She was 97 years old.
Wow.
She just died, like, last week. I went to the funeral, I went to the camp, and blah, blah, blah. I came home, and I'm walking down, and I kind of forgot she died. And I'm thinking, oh, she's looking out the window, like she usually does, you know, my flowers, and see about what might be going on in my house, or whatever. Or that's what, anyway, like there's, and then I thought, she's like not there, but it's almost like she is there, and then there was like her mom, and these people, and that old chain, you know what I mean? I don't know, it just seems kind of like, not like a dream, but like,
kind of like a dream.
Although it's sometimes a little depressing. It's a little depressing, though, I have to say.
Yes.
Because it's like, what's the fucking point?
Good sign.
Good sign. Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not offering any feedback here, but good sign.
Good sign?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you start peering into the nature of your firsthand experience and see it as surreal, and then have a depressive reaction to it because the presumption of meaning, the presumption of utility, and the presumption of continuity have, you know, taken a brief hiatus. Good sign. Because that's what this is, full time.
Or depressing?
No, see, the depression is an organic reaction of association breaking apart. Association, which is confidence in self and confidence in purpose and utility, starts to dissolve. And so it's a very natural reaction that there's depression, there's angst. There's
like
running away.
In the TV bank over there, right? I was thinking, but like that's kind of an illusion too, because I can't really go someplace and touch my money over there. I know.
That's really good.
Well, ask them to stack it up and then go over there and say, "Wow!" and then have just redeposit it. Yeah.
I mean, money is really an illusion.
This is not about anything. It has no utility. It has no purpose. It's not dependent on utility or purpose. It's a dream. It's surreal. What's interesting is that kernel inside oneself that assumes meaning, insists on meaning, asserts meaning, is depressed if there is no meaning, that's gone. Well, it's the radiant hallucination that you are of the nature of a body-mind, that you're a durable creature. Therefore, meaning and utility, purpose.
Yeah, people live longer than they have a sense of purpose, right?
That's what they say.
That's what the myth police say.
That's what the myth police say. Yeah.
Orwellian myth police.
And why not? It makes sense. Sure. Yeah. You take an accomplished yogi who has become much more friendly with the surreal nature of momentary existence and is no longer investing in that this is about something. You could say it's much easier to depart the body. You're just not anchored to the body. You just don't have that same greed motivation that, right, bioluminescent continuity need continue. Right? Naturally, you might become less interested in that you should live a long time or even another moment.
So they have a lot in common with depressed people.
Maybe. Yeah. It's like dolphins and autistic children. Being frightened or reluctant to release all meaning is a very natural sign. It's a good membrane to fuck with.
There's lots of ways to mess with it. You just don't pay attention to what your head says.
A thousand ways to mess with your own head in a, you could say, yogically productive manner. Right. Yeah. What is it that's doing all this? That's you. You're that. You're not the localization, but you are that too. Because this particularizes, it localizes. It makes it appear as if there's 7-point-something billion humans on what we call Earth. So sure, you are the, right, the extrusion of God's dreaming, but you're also God. There's no boundary, there's no separation. You are already of the nature of perfect identity. You can't acquire it through a lucky break or a practice.
So when you say you are of the nature, it's not a little sense of a little stuff that believes your thoughts and things she's doing with stuff.
Yeah, because those, right, little I is, you could say, synonymous with the notion that you are consequential, that you are body-mind.
So the vexing paradoxes or contradictions of everything... It's upsetting and fixing and confusing, but that's just the myth reflecting back. Does that make sense?
Sure. It's everything and nothing at all. Whatever we feel like dreaming into view,
yeah,
as a cogent explanation of subtle weirdness,
yeah,
is great, fantastic. And not that at all.
That's what you said last week. If I could imagine so there's no, you know, that's the experience and something that's happening right now. All yous guys, and your internal experiences, they mean...
Well, they're fantasies as far as you're concerned.
Right? So...
When you go in, can you maybe turn the music down a touch? That'd be great. Thanks. Thank you. Here's the irrefutability of this. Here it is. Pretty fairly plain to see. Doesn't mean I know what it is. Or why. Or what it's up to. But it's self-revealing with no intermediary. And it's feeling primarily. The irrefutability is not because you agree to anything. Right? That this is so is not because you agree.
That doesn't ask permission law.
No.
Dreaming and you hear some noise in your dream and you interpret it and you wake up.
up with some bizarre.
Yeah, you wake up and there's
story
something. Some construction on the street.
To be yourself, what effort need you make? Here, you're yourself. And you're yourself, or the confidence that you have that you're yourself is not the consequence of thought, is it?
It's more a visceral
experience. Absolutely.
You asked a question, it wasn't long ago, about what does this feel like? What does it feel like to be here and alive? Like, what does it feel like to be here? More of a felt sense. Because there is absolutely an unmistakable and there's just an inherent sense that it is wrong, that this is a
unique. And you're not relying on thought or reference, language, concepts. That you are you. Intimately, profoundly, right? Inebriated with radiant being. Thought has nothing to do with it. And it's too strange, too primary, to possibly be reduced to any meaningful language set or consequential if-thens, then-sos. So mind, meaning representation, plays around with the beatitude of measure, of comparison, of language. But that's not what you are. That's not what this is. Are we less than confident because we don't know what this is yet? Right? I mean, isn't that kind of like the aspirant's dilemma? Master, I'm not really that confident because I don't know what this is. And you can say the master scratches her head and says, "What do you mean? How could you not? You're you. And you already know it. But once you try to turn it into something, make it a deliverable, control it, micromanage it, anchor somehow, improve upon it, get it right, then you're fantasizing. That's our dilemma. We make this into something that it's actually not. And then try to make it right.
Make it into a mind of
mine. Fair enough. Yeah, right. Make it into... try to make it or my experiences into something that's idealized. Which is a kind of forgetfulness. Because we forget that I'm already me. This is already this. Fully revealed. So this fools itself into being other than itself. And then, right? Self, individuation, is blossoms, like a bad algae bloom. And then we want to remedy the algae bloom by insisting upon or occupying a better state or the strategy to get to the better state. Because we forgot that, oh, this fools itself into being other than itself. We forgot that. Now we're micromanaging illusion, micromanaging delusion. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, or that it need even be accompanied by any sentimentality, because it's just kind of a secular observation. It can only pretend to fool itself into being other than itself. It can't actually fool itself into being other than itself. It's pretend. Bliss is not dependent on how you feel.
You just need to sit there and pretend that you're so important.
It doesn't seem to be. It seems to be a big
struggle. Not all hair conditioning, not all dummies are smart.
It's really a blissful state, really crappy, like depressed state.
You were walking.
And you contend there's something else there that's not driven by either of those words, right? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, here's this. I don't know what I'm talking about. I can't glean any confidence from the shit that I say. Neither can you. You can't glean any confidence from the shit that you say.
Or think. One of the things I was thinking is there's a saying in AA, and it goes like, you have this like really strong desire to drink or something.
Yeah.
Wait 15 minutes.
Right.
And the mind will change. Like. So I guess that concept somehow, I was thinking that, like, oh, I'm in a really crappy place. Like, you know, a few minutes it'll change, and then it'll be over, and then it's like this, like that. I feel this way and I feel that way. I think this way and I think that way. I do know there's like tendencies to think, rethink thoughts, but patterns of thoughts or themes or something, which would be cool not to have, but.
When we try to feel better about whatever, usually we're relying on body-mind as the barometer, as the feedback mechanism for not feeling so good and then feeling better, which is understandable, of course. But what if the filter of body-mind is not the authority, is not the true measuring rod stick of you?
What is the true measuring stick?
That's the question the yogi asks. What is the true measuring stick? What is this? What is this that's not conditional, that's not dependent upon?
And we started saying, you know, something along the lines of, you know, don't invest that much in your thoughts. Like, don't, your thoughts are just going to be your thoughts, and they're not real. And what
happens? So is the way you feel about things.
They just come and go.
So is your sentimentality.
So as you launch your ship away from that.
Sentimentality is related to thoughts.
Okay.
That
yes.
Your mood relates to thought. My mood's going to be great if I think tomorrow there's something really good coming down the pike.
Yeah, that's right. We're mood junkies, and so we're mood managers. Yeah.
So I think everything's going my way. If I've got a good day today, and things are lined up for tomorrow.
Right. Right.
And you're pointing to something that has nothing to do with it. It's the the being that doesn't have its basis in what thought tells you.
It's what you already are before you or this associates as a body mind.
That's to be made aware.
Seems that way. Yeah. It's not real, it's not true. Because you're always this that is not conditional and not dependent upon body-mind. But if you review a life that seems like a whole shitload of consternation, it's like, no, I've been an asshole most of the time. An unhappy, you know, flailing, disappointed, right, acting out and acting in kind of moron, poser from hell. Yeah, that's me. Oh, yeah, I know that guy.
And the game is up on thinking you're going to fix that or change it. It's like, you just have to throw it, well, this is who I am. That's where the depression comes in. It's like all these things that you think, like, work with that or fix it or, you know, I'm going to do it right this time. You got to just set it down and admit, this is it. That's what I get for now. Might change the next moment.
But again, you can see that that is, you know, psychiatric and corporeal centric. This is not what you get. Because nothing's happening and there's no you to be on the receiving end of get. That could be very useful. Don't negotiate.
There's room in this earth for typical imaginarians for everybody, right?
Appears to be, right? Yeah, I mean, we keep fucking and we keep, then more are born. So it looks like there's plenty of room for, you know, more archetypal imaginariums to pop into view.
Yeah.
And go, wow! Yeah.
Dare I say, for spiritual teachers, too, right? Yeah.
This is a cornucopia.
Yeah.
There might be more teachers than suckers. Who are they going to prey on?
Yeah, their
it's going to be bad, man.
You know, it strikes me that whole idea of learning to teach or being asked to teach is another sort of urge to have purpose.
Oh, yeah, it's a total hallucination.
So, you're doing better if you get everybody else to agree with you, especially if you get people to come to you and pay you for it, then it's like, damn, I must be doing it.
Yeah.
So, close that I can see what's
if you were really, really interested in the aspirant's well-being, you'd never take their money.
But there's a difference between selling amelioration and knowing that's what you're doing and people that just want to help fix their dream experience and claiming that you're offering enlightenment. Or a path to enlightenment.
Everything goes, right?
If you're just helping people muddle through on the dream and making a living for yourself, what the hell? If you're claiming that it's really going to get them somewhere and give them enlightenment, that's a whole other story. I think those are two separate things.
Yeah. You've just created two separate things.
Like
I'm good with it.
When I've offered people, when I say I'll support you and do the work if you want, I'm not addressing anybody that will come to me and say, I'm really looking to wake up. What should I do? I'm looking at people that are just struggling in the dream and it might help. Help me.
Yes. Yeah.
Ultimately, it would be for a while.
I get it. Something happened before now, and that's the way you want to characterize it. Hard to say.
I mean, is it just a byproduct of that archetypal legendary can teach and that it needs to accept.
You know, Joseph Goldstein and his pals over at the Inside Meditation Society follow these, you know, Buddhist precepts or suggestions of dana, right? Generosity. So when you go buy a retreat there, I don't know, it may still be true today, I imagine it is. You pay for the room and the board. That's what you pay for. That's how you register. And after the retreat, you offer an envelope of whatever you can or wish to afford for the benefit of the teachers. That's right. You can also invoice them.
You owe me.
They won't likely pay it, but you can invoice them.
Well, that doesn't... So, yeah, but it's a donation, right? It's based on your...
Yeah, and so that's kind of a nice way to do it.
It's nine, right?
Yeah, and I've been to Joseph Goldstein's house, and it doesn't suck.
Is he inside meditation?
No, he's
not.
Yeah. Is it all green, green technology?
This place is much nicer than mine, and I work.
Yeah.
Well, he works, too. But if you're successful, right, as a teacher, as a persona, as an advisor, as an author, as a lecturer, as a Buddhist adept, you get more dana.
So if you really have a good take it on the road kind of shtick and bring in the crowds and you're milking it for all it's got.
Sure. Yeah. Dana works.
You get what you put out.
Yeah. If you're successful as a charismatic purveyor of bullshit, namely Buddhist enlightenment, you're gonna get dana. They're gonna ante up. He's a master of delusion mongering. He appeals to the myth that you're a body and a mind, that you are a psychiatric and corporeal atmosphere of a discrete and disparate durable nature. And so you want to learn fantastic shit, you want to heal, and you want Ayurvedic intervention, or you want to look as good as Deepak does when you're his age. Or maybe you'll become a successful New Age lecturer and author and purveyor of calendars and supplements. Deepak can't help but to be Deepak. We can't help but to be what we appear to be.
Somebody had to be Judas.
Somebody had to. You know, it's possible to, let's say, not justify ourselves in the context of the popular culture. A lot of our stress, people's stress, is, you know, how am I doing within the context of the popular culture? My job, my money, my house, my investments, my boat, my altruism, my tax dodge, my visits to Cannes, who I know in Hollywood.
When that's going
to
slow you long enough, and you don't get me. You get nothing. You start to drop out of your popular culture.
Yeah.
Be careful. It's a vortex.
Well, revelation is just that way. Revelation is autonomous. And it just organically drops out of having any interest or relationship with popular culture. It doesn't mean you have to go to the woods in Oregon and live in a shack, though that would be fine too.
It's nice to be with people.
Sure.
Even people that don't talk about what we talk about.
Oh, I don't like to be with those people.
It's just lovely to be with.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah. Confused?
Yeah.
Good.
Is something new or is it?
No, it's never present. Like, I'm just trying to figure it out what's happening. I can't. So it's just.
That's right.
Wasted effort.
Well, it has to exhaust itself.
Yeah.
If it's your nature to process in a certain way, right? To organize and arbitrate different memes and qualities and nuances, then you just fulfill that. That's how it works for you. That's how it shows up. And you do it because you love to do it. You're good at it. And it will exhaust of its own, in its own time, of its own nature, it will exhaust. Interest in it, energy, calories dedicated to being the arbiter of the mystery of consciousness will simply relax. This is the same kind of impulse for, you know, it's a kind of a greed. It's an acquisitive reflex. It's a kind of a greedy reflex. Could be that. Could be micromanaging. Could be self-assessment, self-measure, whether according to the popular culture or, you know, spiritual ideals. It could be being the successful arbiter of all kinds of interesting concepts, high, low, and in between, to make sure they line up correctly, like completing a Rubik cube. And it's just, right? It's natural to you. It's just, it shows up. I mean, I have it too. You know, my own nature is like trying to find like the right combination of evocation or vocabulary which seems to represent what I'm seeing or feeling inside in an authentic manner, in a genuine manner. Peering into the nature of consciousness and looking at the puzzle, looking at the geometry, looking at the nature of space, looking at the nature of time, looking at the nature of mind, looking at the nature of identification. Looking at subjects and objects. Is this really a separately, independently existing universe in which we live? Or is your actual experience just a provocative, highly pixelated dream? Your actual experience just happens to be a profoundly depthful, three-dimensional, highly pixelated dream, which has no durability whatsoever. And from that is constructed the apparent sea of a durable, externalized universe outside you. It's a very profound myth.
I can't help but think you've talked about the, like, you know, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, you know, when shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, it feels a lot like just this whole real life experience shit. So, you can find shit hitting the fan if you look.
Oh, yeah. And you go to the yogurt shop.
Go to the what?
Yogurt shop.
It's delicious.
I know. Yeah. Anywhere and everywhere. Because this is chaos. Playful chaos.
I'd like to see, like, the enlightened people all get together and have a good debate.
What would they debate about?
I know. Everybody has something else to say. I just want to see who's going to look like the winner.
Wayne Lickerman tells an interesting tidbit. He says, well, his funny story is like, you have a conference and invite all the enlightened people, and whoever shows up, you know, is not.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the science and non-duality conference. Yeah. Everyone can't wait to peddle their enlightenment wares, to get on the dais, hobnob with friends, be happily enlightened in each other's company, and minister to the paying attendees. Right?
I want it to be like, what's that thing, WWF, like they're going to come in.
Yeah. You're right.
Dialogue.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's fun. I mean, you know, you like Shinzen.
Yeah, I like Shinzen.
Yeah, because he has that wonderful kind of quality of unraveling stuff in a geekish way. Yeah.
He's on YouTube. He's a a teacher, and he had various trainings in different traditions.
He's a Buddhist adept.
Shin, like S-H-I-N.
Zen. Shin Zen.
Yeah. Shin Zen.
But he was talking, you know, when I was listening to talk. You know, he's got different ideas. It's very Buddhist and saying, you know, enlightenment doesn't make you a good person, but it tends to. You know,
if an asshole gets enlightened, are they still an asshole? Probably.
You can have vast amounts of liberation, but that doesn't guarantee any. But he believes that the most highly enlightened person is commensurate with a person who is good and of service.
I'm glad he believes that.
Yeah, that's confusing to me. And then he was saying something like, oh, the way you can prove somebody's enlightened. I only half listened to this. It was something like you would have to, like, you know, have them tortured for like a month and then, I don't know, like the final bit or something like that.
Great.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like,
show of hands.
Yeah, I just thought, well, it's like a lot of work. Why bother?
I think I ever had, it's weird, everybody around you is, like you really totally get that the guy behind the counter is paying for your food is there. Like everybody's in. I've just seen that. It's kind of strange when I start thinking, oh my god, they're everywhere.
You might have been right the first time.
Like at the my reference to Lost, where they all realize that who the other person is.
Isn't it kind of instinctive to arrive at or with a resolution? Right? Yeah. So that's why some of these things appear to satisfy. Right? Even Shinzen's wonderfully considered ways of vetting an enlightened person after a month of torture, or that they're kind or reliable or anything. You see, it's like, okay.
I guess if you do realize it's a big dream, then why be observant to anybody? Which I haven't necessarily. Unless the way Peter makes it sound is, you know, that's just your nature. You're going to do what you're going to do. restroom, a cat, or a burning building, you're just going to do it. But it's not like you would intentionally, like, I'm going to be a servant. That's very confusing.
Why?
She doesn't like cats.
Because you don't like cats.
Don't rescue cats from burning buildings.
Now he's gotten to the bottom of it. Cats? Oh my God.
Go rescue the dogs.
It's walking very lightly.
I don't know. I'm just told this.
Stop it!
Stupid! Why'd you say that?
It's odd, for sure, that this can be, as it is, expressive in the way that it's expressive, and have no resolution, no place to land. That it's not about anything is quite bizarre.
We don't just need to make it about sense. We want meaning.
Absolutely.
We want meaning.
All of those, right? The perpetual machine of assertion, of insistence and demand, projection. And there is no such thing. And that can be confusing. If we are just organically or naturally interested in tying up the loose ends, fitting the puzzle together, and that this arrives, or that I arrive, there could be confusion, there could be frustration. To characterize an enlightened person in contrast to an unenlightened person is, yeah.
It doesn't really work.
So?
I've given up trying to look for earmarks, matching stuff.
I mean, my guru pals from however many years ago, we were all so smitten with the completely miraculous persona and nature and character and behavior of Prahlad Chandra Brahmacharya. I mean, just smitten, in shock. Really, in shock that someone like that could be alive. Like, that's just, it's not possible. But if you remain in shock around the profound demonstrations of a yogi of that order of magnitude, then you forget to wake up.
Is he over there?
It's like when you get seduced by visions.
Well, you're perpetually yeah, comparing and measuring everyone, including yourself, to an extraterrestrial. And everyone, including yourself, falls short.
I just love what you said about, we're from the West. We're probably not going to be, like, walking on water and doing, like, miraculous shit. It doesn't look that way.
Hi, how are you?
It's like we're different. We're just not the same as that traditional.
Some people have good organizational abilities, and I find that astounding.
There are cities in the West. Is this
guys, have you ever seen them like walk on water or do miraculous things?
The shit that you see, that you actually see in a being like that, is so much better than levitating. Levitation is bullshit, man. Nothing. You want to peer into a miracle?
It's like,
levitation? Fuck that noise.
Do you think there's anybody like really alive like that now?
Gotta be.
There's lots of.
Could be.
Could be sitting right here.
Could be.
We don't know what it looks
The dilemma of having the privilege to meeting, you know, a yogi of that quality is that, you know, you get ripped open. But it can also be an obstacle because you compare everyone, everything, every experience to an order of magnitude that is not going to be matched in your lifetime. Personally speaking, it's like, I'm done with it. In terms of idealizing the master in a way that means that I'm a beggar. That's not what he had in mind. He was a beggar, practically speaking, he was a beggar. He lived his life as a beggar.
Well, there's two pits you fall into, comparing yourself to the teacher and saying, well, I obviously fall short, and
clearly
comparing yourself to your memory of your experiences with the master.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything from there on out was going to fall short.
Everything sucks.
There's two big-ass pits.
All of those suck. Yeah, yep. That's right. They both suck.
They're slightly different pits.
Yeah, and I mean, I hang out with my brethren, and, you know, they reminisce, and they do what they do, and I'm... I don't care anymore. I just don't.
You can sing this song. I don't care about you, what about me? Enough about you, what about me?
Well, I mean, I see firsthand what an incredible imaginary obstacle it is to have the unearned privilege of encountering, you know, a yogi of that ilk, and which thankfully ruins your life. It has to ruin your life because once you see magnanimity of that exponential degree, you know this is a dream. It doesn't mean you've matured into the vision, but it ruins your life.
But at least it gives you something substantial to...
No, I know.
But this is the funny thing. How do you put it? I mean, yeah, the reminiscences or, say, the actuality of being around him in whatever moods and weird shit you were going through is a kind of substantiability. But the real revelation of hanging out in his company was to watch the living dream unfold, you could say, at his feet, at his pleasure, which was profoundly insubstantial, or a substantial insubstantiability. It's too bizarre. I mean, his real gift was to so beautifully, with no effort whatsoever, reveal the dream. We would force him to talk once in a while. He would acquiesce.
Was he an Indian or was he
a... Indian.
So you went to India?
Yes. Yeah. But the, you know, guru yoga and all the traditions that value it, which certainly includes Buddhism, it's just a different flavor, you know. Guru yoga of the Vedanta tradition, of the Kashmiri tradition, the Dzogchen traditions, of the Zen tradition, of the forest monastery traditions are all, right, peculiarly unique. I was reading some snippets today from Sri Siddharameshwar Maharaj, who was Nirsagadatta's master. Siddharameshwar. And he was a, in a, call it a lineage, right? Lineage from a, you know, another whatever. And the revelatory yoga that is embodied in their quality of Vedanta is the path of the bird, as contrasted with the path of the ant. So the path of the ant, you could say, is more traditional, you know, Hindu or Buddhist yogic contemplation, purification, right? The arduous process of renunciation, of removing yourself from the vagaries and vicissitudes of the popular culture. And the path of the bird is just... What's this? You look at the nature of radiant being. Give your attention to the irrefutability of radiant being. See that it's unconditioned. That's the path of the bird. And Nirsagadatta in 1961 wrote a foreword to a book that was being slowly assembled from the 1930s of the talks and teachings of Siddha Rameshwar. So Nirsagadatta, the esteemed master and, right, we'll call it author of I Am That, a renowned book, right, in the non-dual world, was writing a preface to the work of his guru, Siddha Rameshwar. And it was loaded, deliciously so, with devotional accolades. Shit that makes you weep. That kind of culture that recognizes the master as the embodiment. And how the master, right, simply, you could say, transmits, transmutes, hangs out, permits you to pick up the wind of your own liberation. And the preface was just, it was beautiful poetry. A very different voice than what you might read in I Am That or other books that were transcriptions of Nirsagadatta's talks.
Isn't there some sort of saying, like, you know, one in a thousand can do it without somebody loving them? Yeah.
Well, there's all, you know, it's like one in a million will consider, one in a million will practice, one in a million will have, you know, fruits of practice, one in a million of those will realize. You know, they like to make it appear as if it's a real thin margin, that you're better off playing the lottery.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's true.
Have you noticed, Jeff, or do you think this is just yet another delusional thought that, like, if you... So we went to the Himalayan Institute, right?
Yeah.
And I haven't been practicing yoga very much for the last year, and I'm, like, you know, surrounded by... And they just happen to have, like, this yoga teacher.
Sure.
But we were in kind of a separate group, and so that was fine. But, you know, and nobody was, we weren't doing yoga except for a sitting thing, just sort of a sitting meditation, very short meditation. And a little talk with this guy who I believe probably has flirted with some of the sitting group as well.
Yeah, flirted.
And so, and then also Ron, who probably also is flirting with some of his stuff, and a few of us, and not like they were masters, but they're people that have been kind of like. Even though I'm like stiff and I'm moving, it's like my head. Something with the thinking.
Yes.
Is better.
Nice.
but is that my, is that just... I mean, I know that you can't really answer this question, but have you noticed with yourself here, you see, like, so to speak, progress?
In myself?
Yes.
Progress?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It seems fast. This whole conversation about this thing.
When compared to yourself.
I'm
like
still
the you
idiot.
Of 10 years ago versus the you of now.
There
we go.
Huh?
Exactly.
Compared to his myth.
Yeah, your myth of 10 years ago to
the myth of you compared to the myth of you
10
years ago.
Yeah, right.
Do you see something that resembles progress? Or is that just yet another?
It's certainly, you know, a valid discovery to make, primarily about yourself, right?
You know, I mean, it's possible if I put a huge amount of effort into it that I could, like, you know, stretch and move like a 20-year-old, right?
Yes, you could, right.
But then I thought to myself,
fuck it.
A lot of work.
That's what I'm doing.
And who gives a shit anyway? Because really, what is my goal with being able to stretch like that?
Yeah.
An ulterior motive beyond all that, but, you know.
Well, that's the path of the ant.
But if stretching and yoga,
I mean, it is
lovely
good
for you. Why not do it? I don't do it thinking it's going to get me anywhere other than happier.
I want to
do it. I do it all the time.
I agree.
Of course.
Yeah,
but I'm not claiming. I come here for a sense of reality, of possibility of what this really is. Yoga is my body.
That's what you
think. No. I like to walk, and I do, you know, we were out on the paddle boat, you know, kayaking, and all forms of exercise, yeah, I do. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that.
So when Nirsagadatta took his guru's, his master's advice, when he immersed himself in the teaching, in the conversation, in the espousal of the nature of revelation, it touched him very deeply. He saw that it was true, that it was a path with heart. So he just found himself immersed in it. He took the advice and found himself, you could say, meditating or spending long periods of time enjoying, feeling, reveling in consciousness, radiant nature.
Yeah, but he didn't have that.
He had Bombay.
He didn't have what?
He had Bombay. And he probably didn't have too much security in terms of knowing that his... his next meal was
going to
be there if he didn't muster up for patient
security, but what didn't even occur to him?
This was nothing. It's not conditional.
I'm sure, right?
This draws you in, and it becomes the principal discovery. You're not.
So even if we're like, I don't know why I'm doing this, I'm not going to do it anymore. It just happened. Just end up here. Pretty nice.
Oh, we keep feeling sorry for ourselves.
Yeah, really. I quit 4 months ago. Just haven't caught up with my own decision.
Just a fugue state, you know.
Who are you people? It's kind of funny. There was a subtle shift in what we were doing here when we switched from the invitation to take a look. to sort of this guru and that guru and talking about it, like enlightenment almost like as an entity.
Yeah.
It shifted stuff. It was like, it was nowhere near as wide open. Like, it took it and sort of put it more in a box. It ignores just what's in front of you and what's right here. When you start to talk about it as a thing that I am going to.
All comparison, all measure, all destination is imagination. Is imagination.
How does music fit into the whole picture?
Any way you want it to.
Because there is words, and they're about stories, and they're about... But there is this sort of, like, vibration.
Well, they say that's how most people experience spiritual experiences. Yeah.
That's a powerful one too.
There's a whole variety.
God, I hope you don't play music when you're having sex. We'll never see you again.
This guy's song gets boring compared to this.
Like 7 to 10. Bo Derek, then she played Bolero.
Yeah.
When I was in junior high, I was obsessed with Life After Death, Ray and Moody.
Rudy?
Raymond Moody.
Oh, yeah.
He did all this research. And I would just read all I could about that because I think it was, you know, that people have the same effects. Have this experience of death, and they would feel this profound freedom. They would report that back when they were revived, and then after that they would have this very little fear. So,
you're
I don't know why I said that.
Did you see the movie Fearless?
I did. It was really good. That's pretty different. Did you get the rock to have had in your life?
Well, you can play music, have sex, and asphyxiate.
And choke yourself out.
Have a near-death experience. Make sure your partner is aware that you've just about stopped breathing, you know, so that he or she can resuscitate you, and then you'll have the magic formula.
There are people doing that. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
We should do like a
quadruple. How do we get them to come here?
It's time to pull out all the stops.
Was that the safe word? Or was that
yeah, right. I forgot the safe word. Too late.